Hi, and welcome to the final addendum in the Undisclosed series tracking the HBO documentary, The Case Against Adnan Syed. This is Rabia here, and I am happy to be your host this week as John Cryer could not join us this week, but I am here with the entire Undisclosed team, Susan and Colin. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey, guys.
Good. How are you?
Oh, what was that? I was like, please start. Anyway, also, we have a very special guest with us to cap off this series, and I'm so excited to have him on. Adnan's attorney, who everybody knows from watching this series, but also I've known forever, Justin Brown. Justin, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Hey, Robbie, it's good to be here. I think it's been a couple years since I've been on Disclosed.
We'd like to have you on anytime you want to come, but you know, you're a busy man. You're a busy man.
No. I should always be careful what I wish for. But no, I'm happy to be here today.
And I know this is a really, really busy time for you. I know you're preparing for next step in Adnan's case, but we won't keep you on too long. But there's some things that, you know, I want to talk about. But Susan and Colin, before I get into the kind of things that are on my mind, if there's anything you want to bring up with Justin first, I'll let you guys go first.
Wait, what's that deadline, Justin, for the reconsideration?
It's due on Monday.
Okay. Fun weekend for you.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Well, I wanted to start off by talking about kind of the process of making this documentary series. I want to ask you, Justin, first of all, why did you agree to doing it? And then what was it like working with Amy?
At first, I was pretty apprehensive about getting involved with this, as you recall. And we certainly had a lot of discussions between the two of us. But, you know, at a certain point, number one, my client wanted to do it. Number two, I had the sense that it was going to get done with or without my participation. and then number three, I thought in the long run, it's going to be helpful. And again, every decision I make, the first thing I have to ask myself is, what is the effect of this going to be on my client's case? We recognized that we could potentially be in a desperate situation, and in a desperate situation, which we ended up being in, which we're in now, it's beneficial to have this type of publicity and to have sort of the investigative resources that HBO had. You know, it's the kind of thing that can help the case under certain circumstances. And, you know, I think it turned out to be a wise decision because I do think the documentary has and will continue to help us.
Well, can I ask you, I don't know what it was like for me. I didn't work closely with Amy's team. I know a lot of people, like, they'll see the name that I'm an executive producer on it, but that's only because of the book being optioned. But I really didn't work closely with the investigators or Amy herself. Once in a while, I would hear what was going on. But for the most part, I had to watch the series to find out. But what about you? Were you pretty closely involved with their investigation and what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, there were certain agreements that were made throughout the course of the filming. You know, there were some things that, you know, I would say and kind of reserve the right to look back at, you know, based on how things turned out. Because we were obviously operating in real time for a lot of this. It was really important to develop some trust with them. You know, I had to know that if there was something that got in there, you know, that I shouldn't have said, that I said by mistake, if, you know, if certain privilege issues were violated, things like that, I had to trust that they weren't going to put that in sort of an unfair way. But at the same token, you know, they're journalists, essentially, and, you know, they're producing their movie. So I had to be as cautious as I could. And I'll tell you, I mean, it was terrible. Like, I did not, I love Amy, and I think she's fantastic, and her team is great. And by the end of this, I trusted them quite a bit, and I still do, and I think they're wonderful people. But being mic'd up and having cameras follow me around, I did not enjoy it. It stressed me out. It made my job a lot harder. But again, for sort of the bigger cause, I was willing to do it. I think, Robbie, I think you were a much more natural person to film than I was. I mean, I
struggled with it. Justin, you have no idea how many times they would say, can you go back in the house and walk back out to the car again? Can you just do that one more time?
I just remember that there was one scene and it never made it into the film where they were inside my house and I had to like kiss my wife goodnight and then and then up the stairs, and they kept making me do it over and over again. And it got worse and worse.
You have to ask them for that footage. You just got to have that footage for yourself.
It looked like a really bad soap opera, but.
Well, I'll tell you this. This past Thursday when they had the screening of the fourth episode, I think once Amy got a few drinks in her, she leaned over and said to me, Rabia, we edited you to make you look really good. I was like, thanks. I appreciate that. So I wanted to ask you one thing, though. So we do hear from Adnan in the series. We don't see him. Was that a call that you made that he wouldn't be on camera?
No. HBO mounted a monumental effort to interview him at the prison. And again, that was something that I was, you know, a little bit uncomfortable with. But at the end of the day, I was willing to allow it. And it was something that Adnan wanted to do and was willing to do. Initially, they got permission from the prison to do it. So everyone was geared up and ready to go out there. And it would have been unprecedented. I'm not aware of any other interviews that have been conducted inside of a Maryland prison. But at the very last minute, Amy was informed that the DOC had changed their mind and they kind of pulled the plug on the idea. So that's why he never appeared on film.
Mm. So I'm going to, Susan Collin, I don't want to hold all the Justin's time. So I'm going to let you guys take the floor for a bit and pick his brains on what you want to before we move on to some of our listener questions.
Yeah, no, I just think as an attorney, like, I mean, you made a bold call, Justin. I think it was the right call and it paid off in the end. That mean agreeing to even let part of your conversations with the client about plea negotiations get recorded. It's a sign how much you trusted Amy and how much you trusted the process. And that couldn't have been comfortable at all.
Yeah, that was definitely the hardest part of the process is the decision of whether to make them privy to those conversations and that process. And again, it's something we weighed very carefully. It's something I discussed with my client. And at the end of the day, we decided to do it.
This will be a little bit outside the scope of the series, but if we go back to the oral arguments in the Court of Appeals, I know you've touched upon this a bit before, but the decision was made to have you not conduct the oral arguments there. And can you sort of go into the thought process of how that came about where Kate Stetson would be presenting those oral arguments?
And this is for the most recent hearing at the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that went into that decision. You know, number one, Kate Stetson is
one. Beast.
She's a beast. No, she's a very nice woman. But she is one of the best oral advocates in the country. I mean, she is an absolute superstar. This is what she does, every day of the year for 15 hours a day. She goes from one, high pressure appellate argument to another. And in the course of prepping and getting ready, you know, she offered to do it. I by this time I had known her for more than a year. I had seen that she was getting more and more involved in the case. She was gaining a very good understanding of the facts and the record. And, it was a hard decision for me because I had to, this case is my baby and I had carried it for so long, but I had to make the decision that was best for my client. And I thought that while I could have done an adequate job, I thought Kate added a nice touch to the case. I thought it would, kind of surprise our opponents. And I thought she would kick ass, which is exactly what she did. And also, you know, the other thing is I was tied up with other things related to the case, you know, and it allowed us to operate separately on two different tracks at the same time. So it just made a lot of sense, but it was a very hard decision to make, but I'm satisfied that I made the right decision on that.
What are the difficulties of growing a client-based business? If you're a small business owner, HoneyBook.com can help you spend less time handling the administration work and more time doing what you love. HoneyBook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. HoneyBook makes it easy to streamline your process. With client and calendar management tools and custom branded proposals and contracts, you can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, and get paid faster, all within one online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of hours a year with HoneyBook. And that's why we've partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer Undisclosed listeners 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with the promo code Undisclosed. So get started at HoneyBook.com today and use promo code Undisclosed for 50% off your first year. Again, that's HoneyBook.com, promo code Undisclosed.
Justin, can I ask you a bit about, I mean, can you tell us about when you reached out to Baltimore police years ago to ask about what evidence remained for DNA testing and the response you got, and then how you found out that it actually existed?
Yeah, it's funny because I had largely forgotten about that. It happened so long ago, and then I saw the old email. We asked them about the state of the evidence. I think it was in 2009, very early. It must have been
08.
Okay, so it must have been literally like right when I was first hired on the case. I mean, it very, very, very early in the process. And I received a response from the police saying essentially that they didn't have the evidence anymore. There was a little caveat at the end of the email saying, you know, while we can't be 100% sure, but this is how it looks right now. We don't have any of the evidence. So, and when you hear that from the police, you're largely at their mercy. You know, they're saying it's not theirs. You can't demand to go in and search, you know, through the basement of the police department. So, you know, that was sort of one of our assumptions of what was going on moving forward. That proved to be incorrect. And
that's diplomatic, Justin. Incorrect is like implies that it was not abundantly obvious in their system where the evidence was.
Yeah, and you know, who knows how these things happen? I mean, it could have been that the person who was responding to the request was just
completely
really
confident.
Busy. He was just busy or lazy and didn't feel like dealing with it. So, you know, he blew it off.
That's inexcusable. But let me ask you this. When Deirdre Enright brought this up, when Cyril was ongoing, she at that point, we still didn't know. She didn't know that it actually existed, but she was going to try and seek that to see if it was, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Okay. So when did you find out that it's there?
So, you know, and I don't want to get into too much details about this, but I'll explain it a little bit. As we started, you know, talking to the state, there was sort of a mutual desire to do some DNA testing. Both parties went through the evidence list, the same evidence list, you know, that's existed forever, the inventories, and picked out things of interest. Those were then submitted, those lists were submitted to the police, and lo and behold, you know, the evidence was there.
So this happened sometime in the last half of 2018, right?
Right. Yeah, late 2018. That's right.
So let me just say this. You know, we saw Sarah Dill in the documentary, and Sarah Dill conveyed to me a while ago that Thiru Vignaraja had told her that they have the evidence, and she asked him, and she says it in the documentary, why didn't you test it? So they've known they've had it. That pisses me off. But anyway, all right, I just want to put that out there. Well, let me ask you this. What is revealed in this documentary, and then the Baltimore Sun reported this too, that there is a full female profile. that's nowhere in the system, doesn't hit anything. And then you also have some fingerprints that don't appear anywhere in the system. Is that the end of the line? I mean, like the state seems to say, well, we're not doing anything with that. Is there anything anybody else can do with that?
I think so. You know, the first thing that would have to happen, because we're no longer in active litigation, so we can't, in all likelihood, we can't force the state to do anything with the DNA, but there might come a time when we can approach the state and see if they're willing to turn that over to us so that, you know, we could potentially, you know, get a I'm not even sure what the right term for it is, a genealogist to run it through various databases and see if that can help. So yeah, that's an option that's on the table.
And do you have any more insight into like what happened with the presumably partial profiles that were obtained? Not in the fingernail clippings, but on the bottles and like, well, the condom wrapper, which I'm less concerned with.
So this was a very informal type of DNA testing. In other cases that I've had where it's been done comprehensively in like the pre-trial phase, you know, you get hundreds and hundreds of pages of reports on the DNA results. Here, because this was done in an abbreviated fashion, the documents that have been publicly released that's everything that I have. So you have all the information that I have. I haven't been able to, you know, get any of the supporting documentation if it exists. And
it has to exist, right? I mean, if it doesn't exist, we got bigger problems than I thought we had in Baltimore.
I don't know. I don't know that for sure. It could be that it was done in such an abbreviated manner that, you know, a lot of it wasn't documented. I just don't know.
Yeah. One of the things that jumped out of Susan, and she brought this up, I think either last week or it was this week's episode, maybe, was how brief this DNA report was and all the things that seem that it should have had and is missing. And, you know, Susan, if you ever get a chance to drill down on any of the folks who ran the testing, please take Susan with you. So one thing I wanted to talk about actually that was towards the end of this last episode was the QRI investigators raising alternate suspects in this case. And I saw And some folks commenting on social media and some other podcasts, in fact, that they didn't think, number one, that that's like the right thing to do. You know, shouldn't point fingers at private citizens. At a minimum, at least one of those people is innocent, if not both. And I thought that was, I mean, was that an issue for you to talk about alternate suspects? And also legally, what can you do with anything that might point to an alternate suspect?
Yeah, I mean, that's an area that I've tried to stay out of. You know, I've got my own opinions about that, but.
Oh, Justin, tell us. No. Okay, tell me private.
Safe space, here, I'm here.
We've all got opinions about it. And, you know, if I understand why they have to do that. And that's the way things get investigated. You know, if you're not looking at alternative suspects, you can't conduct an investigation. And so for that reason, I understand why QRI did that. And I understand why HBO put it in. But, you know, I don't feel like that's my place or my job to try to figure out, you know, who did this. As a trial attorney, I like an alternative suspect to suggest to a jury that, hey, person A could have done this, person B could have done this, person C could have done this, and therefore we have reasonable doubt. That's kind of how I view it. But, you know, other people view it differently, and that is what it is.
Well, the problem in any case is you always have people saying, well, if not the defendant, then who? Assuming that because they can't think of anyone else and because no one's being pointed at, that no one else could possibly exist. And in many cases, that's absolutely not true. Like, there are so many options that are unexplored that the impression given is that, like, oh, there's no one else that you could even look at, when in reality, there's so much there that was never looked at in the first place.
Right. Just as a trial tactic, I have always believed that you've got to give the jury a plausible narrative of why your client did not commit the crime. And that's when alternative suspects become extremely useful.
You shouldn't have to, but in reality.
Right.
Yeah.
But can they be, our listeners have asked, you know, and people who watch the series have asked, but what about in the appellate process, what you're handling now? Can any information on alternate suspects be useful at this point or not?
I think it potentially can. You know, there's two ways that you can, I mean, when you file something in court, you're putting together a factual section. And, you know, if you have really strong facts, that might not necessarily amount to a post-conviction issue. Sure, you can include them. You can sort of backdoor them into a filing and include them and include affidavits and supporting documents that prove the facts that you're trying to establish. So you can kind of get it before the court indirectly, even if it doesn't amount to a standalone issue that can gain post-conviction relief. So in that sense, it can be important. But, you know, if you can find the person who committed the crime, then sure, that's a innocence petition right there.
Right. So a few questions that I'm going to take off the Twitter for you is just to wrap this up, last few minutes you have. First of all, do you do wrongful convictions often? And is there a case that you're handling that you wish could get more attention, like a nun's?
I do handle a lot of these types of cases. It's a substantial portion of my practice. I've got one case in particular that I've been working on, which takes place on the eastern shore of Maryland, in which my client was convicted of a murder with virtually no reliable evidence. And we are trying to develop some new leads and figure out a way to prove his innocence right now. But that's a case we're focused on at the moment.
Awesome. Thank you. Question, because we've seen this with attorneys from other cases, including Brendan Dassey and Stephen Avery, but have you ever considered doing a speaking tour around the U.S., maybe in other big cities, to get more support? And
that sounds
and
just kind like of... Justin.
Exactly. But, you know, Justin's good on a mic. We've seen this many times.
Yeah, you know, it's something I would consider. I mean, no one has asked me to do it, so I haven't really crossed that bridge yet. But
here's
look,
the answer.
My feeling is this. I want to advocate for Adnan. And, you know, at this point, I am so deep into this that I'm willing to do anything and try anything. And I want to keep fighting and I want to try to turn this thing around. So I feel that way about this case. And I also have been doing this long enough and I've seen enough of the problems in our system that I do have very strong feelings about how our system needs to change and why that's important and why so many innocent people continue to be in prison right now. So I do have things that I would like to say about that. I think this case is a really good vehicle for doing that. But, you know, in terms of doing something like that, you know, the timing would have to be right. I'd have to get permission from my wife and, and I, you know, I would probably only do it if you guys were involved as well.
I'd be there to watch you if you did.
Oh, you'd be there to watch me. Okay, yeah.
I'll be there to set it all up. So, final question, because this is a question we get over and over and over hundreds of times now in the last couple of weeks. What next? Now that the Court of Appeals has denied Adnan a new trial, where do we go from here?
So right now we are putting together a motion for reconsideration, in which we're asking the same court that just ruled against us to reconsider its opinions. We think they have made some errors that probably they did not intend to make. And we're going to ask them, you know, to look at it again. It's admittedly a long shot, but, you know, we are putting an enormous effort into filing the best motion that we possibly can. And that's due in a couple of days. So I've been really busy with that. So that's the most immediate thing. And then after that, we will, if that fails, we will petition to the Supreme Court. And after that, you know, I think once we get through this this motion for reconsideration, we're going to sort of sit down and bring some people together and try to figure out what's the best next strategy. But we haven't reached any conclusions on that yet.
It is a long shot, and I don't want to ever put any hope in a motion for reconsideration. But the thing that gets me, going back to the opinion, is that there just is no recognition from the court that they're making Maryland such an outlier in terms of like the national jurisprudence on this issue, which seems strange. If you're going to take your state in such a different direction from everyone else, you'd think there'd be more acknowledgement of that in the case itself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, it's unusual to me, and I don't fully understand why they did it or how they did it, but I agree with that characterization. You can look at all of the case law all over the country, and it's all very different from this opinion. So, you know, and that isn't necessarily a reason for granting reconsideration, but it is something that they should probably take a careful look at. And I can assure you that will be pointed out in our filing.
When can we expect the Court of Appeals to make a decision on this motion?
My understanding of the process is that they'll have a conference during which they'll consider it. And, you know, the first conference after our filing will occur, I think, the second to last week of April. I can't remember the exact date, but I think it's the week of the 22nd. So, you know, at that conference, maybe they'll make a decision and we could hear shortly thereafter.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you so much for taking time out of this very, very, I know, precious time right now as you're getting this motion ready. And I'm sure doing work for other clients to come and talk to us about this. And maybe we can have you back on when there is some kind of decision from this court to hear more about what's next.
If you guys will have me back, I'll be back.
Think about it.
Anytime. Thank you again, Justin. Thank you for all you have done for all these years.
Thanks a lot. It's great talking.
Right, take care.
All right,
bye-bye. All right, guys, so let's get into what did you guys want to talk about from this final episode?
From my perspective, the biggest revelation is, and you know, you can't trust what Jay has to say. I understand that. But there's this phone call they say they have with him in January 2019. And one of the things he says is that he made an afternoon visit to Woodlawn High School to look for Adnan and couldn't find him. And, you know, again, it's Jay, can you trust him or not? But if you go back to his pre-interview from his very first police interview, he says initially he went to Woodlawn at 3 o'clock p.m. And everything that Jay says, you can kind of say, well, maybe he's trying to cover from someone else or he's trying to protect his family. But I don't see any way in which him saying I went to Woodlawn in the afternoon helps his case at all. And so I kind of trust that. And I think that happened, which has huge ramifications for everything in this case, I think.
See, I just don't think Jay really recalls that day at all. He recalls some of it, bits and pieces. But I think he's just trying to piece together a narrative for himself because he doesn't know what happened on the 13th.
But that, why in the world would he say he went to Woodlawn at 3 o'clock? Especially,
that could have been his normal pattern to go after school, before track, giving on his car back. So that could be what he's assuming he did. And maybe he did do that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. But it's, you know, this is January 2019. It's possibly on the eve of Adnan's conviction being thrown out. And for Jay to place himself at Woodlawn on that afternoon and say he didn't actually see Adnan at that time, that just seems crazy to me, unless, in fact, that's what happened. And again,
more crazy or less crazy than the 10 pounds of weed?
there's that.
But
too.
At least that's at least, you know, explaining his behavior. It's saying he got this leverage on me.
There's a reason. Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. That Jay line makes sense to me because Jay has a story now that he was pressured because of the marijuana thing.
Right.
And because it's Jay, he has to make the story bigger and cooler. So now we've gotten to the 10 pounds. So yeah, I get that.
I mean, the thing about Jay is not so much what he's saying, but why he's saying it. I think that's a valid question that Colin is raising is what is the move here. Like I don't think he randomly inserted that. Like he said, the 10 pounds, you're right. He's making it bigger and cooler and showing how much pressure he's under and he could really go away for years for 10 pounds of weed. What you know, I understood when he made the pivot to the Burial of Midnight, that's probably in response to lividity stuff, but what was the point of, it's always like, what is the method to the madness?
I am not that confident there's any method here. From like, I just don't, I used to think there might be more to, I definitely thought there was
giving him too much credit.
Yeah, no, I definitely thought there was probably more of a, I don't think there's even like a plan in any sense. He responds in the moment. I think that's why he's so willing to sort of change the stories now, as it seems like, I mean, mine's just a very general impression, is that he has parts of the story that he thinks are like totally obviously so untrue that he's not even going to try and defend it. Like, he's not even, he's like, oh, of course I was in Best Buy. That's stupid. So he's happy to ditch a part of the story. And there's other parts that he kind of, you know, sort of once in a while goes back to the spine of it because he feels like it's more important, like the he saw a body thing. So he keeps going back to that, even though he can't decide where he saw it. But it's not like a strategic move there. It's just like him clutching to what he feels like he can still clutch to.
Well, I'll say this. It could be. I mean, imagine this scenario that, like, you know, when Adnan gave him the car, because if Adnan did ask Hay for a ride, maybe he said to Jay, I might want to pop back home. You can check with me after school. Otherwise, get me after track practice. And maybe Jay did swing by, didn't see him at that point. Around three, he would have been headed into track practice anyways. And then he didn't see him, and that's it. So it could be something that possibly happened. But at the same time, of course, we have this repeated testimony and statement saying that he didn't leave Jen's place until 3:45. So,
but think about the Players Club. Why would Jay have told the police in his first interview they went to the Players Club after the murder? There's no reason. There's no plan. That's just Jay making Jay stuff up.
Right. But it doesn't implicate him. Whereas this, if he's placing himself at Woodlawn in the afternoon there, that could very easily be used to tie him to the crime. Like, so there's sort of
realize that. Yeah. I don't think he's figured that part out.
Well, but yeah, well, I mean, look, Jay should know that by now. I mean, the 2:36 p.m. call is the most important call. What I don't understand is this, how he can maintain, basically what he's saying is this. Okay, what he is saying is none of that happened. The come and get me call didn't happen. None of that happened because he didn't even see the body until later that night. Like, he's pretty much thrown all that out. And so by saying he swung to the school, he didn't even have to care about the 2:36 call because he's already saying that none of that happened. I mean, back in 2014. And he's saying that the police made up the Best Buy. He was never at Best Buy.
To the extent you can tell about Jay's strategy or make any conclusions at all, I mean, another explanation that works as well as any other is that he's trying to kick out Asia from the narrative.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, yeah, you don't, yeah, Asia doesn't matter because who cares if he has an alibi for then, because that's not when he was missing from track, weirdly.
I'm going to have to let that marinate some more. But
reading too deeply into anything Jay says.
All right. Well, there's that. Well, let me ask you, Colin, you said that was one of the big things that jumped out at you. What about, like, as we look at the series overall, and I've seen a lot of conversation online about this. People are like, well, you know, Undisclosed covered that, and we kind of knew that information. But there was stuff still that surprised me and kind of hit me new. And to me, the documentary for that reason was important and impactful because there are lots of people who have not been following anything after Serial. And also they brought in voices that were not necessarily like us. It's people who are just completely independent, and they brought them in and they reached similar conclusions. So both of you, I'm asking you the question, kind of what were the most kind of impactful parts of this documentary or things that surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, the most impactful thing for me by far is Christy's class schedule, her realization she couldn't have missed the class. Because, you know, we touched upon this earlier, if Christy has the wrong day, that not only impacts her memory, it impacts Jay's, it impacts Jen's. It means essentially everything after 4:12 p.m. on January 13th that's part of the state's case is out the window. And so for me, that was the huge revelation that just tears apart everything the state has to say.
What I think the documentary pulled together so well was just sort of to isolate and expose the nature of the story being told against Anand and how it is not this massive, corroborated, intricate set of interlocking stories. It is Jay, who will say basically anything. And it's Jen and Christy over here who are confused and think Anand's guilty and are basing their decisions off of that. But they honestly think they know this thing that happened on the 13th. But actually, well, they don't. And it seems like their parents did not. Then Jay's story isn't corroborated by anything. Like, it's not a case of like Jen and Christy and Jay conspiring to make a story against Anand. It is just Jay telling stories and Christy and Jen going along with what the cops told him.
Let me ask you this, because for me, I mean, like, the first time I realized, like, and I think it was a blog that Colin wrote, but the first time I realized, like, what the lividity evidence showed, I was like, that is enough to impeach all three of them. Like, none of anything they're saying matters or is relevant or obviously can be accurate. Does it even matter that they contradict one another when you've got like this scientific piece of evidence? Like, how can you reconcile that with anything that any of them have to say anyways?
Well, Christie never mattered in the first place. Like, her, okay. She's not lying. She's just, her story has no relevance to the story of what happened to Hay.
Yeah. And it's, you know, to your point, Robbie, is the story is that we had the Linkin Park pings in the 7 o'clock hour. We then in the 8 o'clock hour have Jay saying, we just buried Hay. Let me wipe off these shovels, the shovel and the pick. And yeah, obviously if Lividity by multiple experts now.
And before that, they went to Christie's, right? I mean, like,
yeah, yeah. It all sort of ties together. And if this burial couldn't have taken place until 10:30 at the earliest, well, that just means that this house of cards falls apart, that what Jen is saying couldn't have happened in this 8 o'clock hour. And it just makes it look like this is something that was sort of pieced together through Jay, Jen, and the police in some fashion.
Yeah. I mean, if we could go back in time, I wish someone in the BPD had been like, common sense tells me no one's going to move a body from a car on a busy, like, commuter road at 7 o'clock. The whole, like, the premise of this whole story, which had to be the premise because of 7 o'clock calls, is based on an idea that's insane. Of course I didn't move a body out of a car next to a very, very busy road that has tons of commuter traffic still going on. It didn't happen. Right. Like, and it only ever was that way because that ping. It all started with the 7 o'clock pings. And then from there, this whole story evolved.
And the police worked backwards. And the other thing is, like, if you've ever been out there, we're talking close quarters. There's just two lanes. When the cars are passing you, they can look right at your face. I mean, this is not like really spread out territory. Something, Colin, people keep asking this question. I just want you to go on the record. Is anything in this episode, was anything in the series, the bombshell?
It was not, no.
All right, everybody, relax. That's still out there. In fact, there's, I think, a couple of big pieces of information that still exist that, and there's more potentially that's developing too. But so somebody asked the question, can we talk about the car for a second? Crime Writers On brought this up, and I actually, when they brought it up, I also kind of didn't connect the dot, but this kind of makes sense. I don't know if you heard their episode this week, but they said they actually found fault with the documentary for not more obviously connecting the dots, kind of like Rebecca specifically said she wanted, like, in Colin's voice, and I did too, but Colin's voice to be there to say, this is significant because X, this connects to X. And one of the things they said was, when they asked that lady who lived in the neighborhood, the car was found, and I apologize, I can't remember her name. She said, you know, if we had seen a car there for more than a few days, we would have called the police. And then you jump to, how did Jay know the car was there? I mean, one of the most kind of natural conclusions might be that they did see the car there. Somebody, a resident, saw the car there for a few days and called the police. And then the police watched it for a few days. And then maybe the police told Jay instead of one of the police moving it or somebody else moving it. But the car was, in fact, spotted there. Yeah. But
this happens
not
all
longer.
The time in that neighborhood. Like, I can't even, like, there's several cases now in Baltimore that I've looked at or been involved in. And just a scenario just like that went down. I mean, again and again, that's what you have. You have lots of stolen cars in general, not all of them connected to the murders, but they usually get stolen. If they're often just ditched in like an alleyway behind a house. Someone calls it in and they get it pretty quickly. And in murder cases,
wouldn't there be a record of somebody calling it in then?
So yes, but would we have it? I mean, in one case I'm looking at, they found the car. It was a murder victim's car. It was left Edmondson Village, so pretty close to where Hay's car is ultimately found. And we know it was reported because I do have a report that mentions the officer, like why they were out there. But there actually is no report from the neighbor who called it in. We don't even know that because of a stray comment someone wrote in a narrative. But we don't actually have any documentation showing how they found the car. But according to the one officer, it's because a neighbor called, as usual, and says, hey, this car has been out here for a bit. And they did watch the car for a couple days. So, yeah, that whole basic scenario is very common.
So you couldn't, for example, MPIA, ask for, do a public information request for police blotter calls from like this date to this date, let's say,
But
then you wouldn't really know would you be able to get like the actual audio or the transcript of what was said? Or, and there's got to be more, because this is the kind of stuff that's used at trials and evidence and all these things. I mean, like, you know, these things must have more documentation.
Well, but now in 2019, it's a different question from whether it was documented back then. Mm. Well, so my point being, it's not only that can happen and it could easily not be in the case file.
Right. That I would, in fact, expect. Oh, this was an interesting question. And this relates to the car again. And this is about the grass in the wheel well, you know, Susan, that you spotted years ago. Somebody asked, does it look like it's been cut, actually? Is it not just the way that that gentleman described it, where it's like, you know, just kind of like detritus? I don't know, whatever that word is. Detritus. Junk, basically. Is it just junk that the tires picked up, or was it actually freshly, does it look like freshly cut grass? And if it was that area cut? I don't think that's the kind of lot that gets the grass cut, especially in the winter.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. It sounds like a question for the turf physiologist, but I'm going to just speculate. I don't think they're cutting that lot in the winter forever.
Do you think the grass in the wheel well looked like it was cut grass, though?
I don't think I have any opinion on what cut grass versus kicked up grass would look like, so.
Mm. Well, I mean, obviously, if you're looking at it physically, you can easily tell. Have you mowed? I'm sure you've mowed some lawn, Susan. You know that.
But from a picture, no. I mean, I would love to hear if Erwin wanted like give an opinion on it. But no, I don't know if there's any more there.
All right. Well, that wraps up our coverage of this documentary series and our special kind of series on it. And Susan, Colin, thank you guys. And Colin, thank you for blogging continuously and constantly about this. If you guys haven't checked out Colin's blog, please do.
He has like 5 million posts up now.
He has a lot of posts about the series, about like individual little aspects of the series. So please check that out for more information. And Susan and I will blog one day again. I don't know when. We'll see. But anyway, we'll be back in, I think, a couple weeks with our new season of Undisclosed. And we are excited for that. And then we've got a whole year of cases lined up for you guys, new cases. And of course, we will always, always continue to track development in the Nans case. I do want to give you a heads up. We will have a special episode of Undisclosed next week that's going to drop, kind of a bonus. I'm not going to tell you what. Okay, guys. Right. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people. Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.